Hello, and welcome to this podcast miniseries on coastal resilience in the face of climate change. I'm Josephine Anselin. I'm a PhD student at the University of Cambridge, and I'm currently doing a policy internship at the Centre for Science and Policy here in Cambridge. Through this podcast series, I'm hoping to shed some light on coastal resilience, a topic that has been close to my heart ever since witnessing coastal management issues firsthand while living in Jakarta, Indonesia's capital city, which has also been referred to as the world's fastest sinking city. In each episode of the podcast, I'll be talking to a different coastal research expert. And together, we'll explore a specific aspect of the UK's coastal adaptation to climate change. We'll discuss some of the latest science, the links between academic research and policy, as well as steps that academics can take to help bridge the gap between coastal science and policy action. In today's episode, I'm very pleased to be joined by Dr. Jenny Brown to speak about flood forecasting. Dr. Jenny Brown is a coastal oceanographer at the UK's National Oceanography Centre. Her expertise are in wave, surge, tidal, and storm impact modelling. More recently, she has become involved with technology development to validate flood forecasting capability. Her current research is focused on new flood hazard monitoring systems to support coastal management decisions and assess the resilience of coastal schemes as we move towards the use of nature-based solutions. So without further ado, let's get into this conversation. First of all, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation today and for sharing your expertise. And I'd like to start by asking you what personally motivated you to become a coastal oceanographer and specifically to work on flooding and coastal hazards related topics?
Well, I always wanted to work with the sea. So as a child, I took up kayaking as a hobby and thought it would be great to have a job that kind of linked to what I enjoyed doing. So I set out trying to find university courses that were linked to oceanography. As I started to learn more about oceanography, I realised that where the sea meets land is where a lot of impacts happen. So I've been really lucky and managed to get a career working in flood risk, flood hazards. And I feel this is where research can have a real benefit to society. And I think it's really interesting. So I've stayed in that field since I've started working at the National Oceanography Centre.
Oh, that's brilliant. So have you found some fieldwork opportunities where you could use your kayaking skills?
Oh, no, I haven't. So there would be quite a lot of safety requirements when you do field work.
Yeah.
I still do that as a hobby, though.
So one way to enhance coastal resilience is by improving our ability to predict flood risk. And prediction of flood risk is what we're focusing on in today's episode. So could you please give a brief overview of the processes that drive or that control coastal flooding?
Yeah, so coastal flooding could be caused by very high tides, and these could be storm tides. So when we have a storm surge coinciding with the highest tides and during the spring neap tidal cycle. We also have wave processes on top of the tidal levels, which can elevate water levels, or waves can impact seawalls and overtop them, which is when spray shoots over the top of the seawall. But at the coast, we also need to remember that rainfall and river flows also have effects. Wherever there is a built environment, a community, heavy rainfall creates surface flooding. And also in estuary communities, they're coastal, but they have the double whammy of coastal processes and also the river flows coming into the estuary, and they can interact. So I'd say at the coast, it's not just coastal flooding. It's flooding from a whole range of sources that can be a challenge and need to be managed.
That's really interesting. And it's true that often when we do think about coastal hazards, we think mostly about hazards coming from the from offshore. So yeah, thanks for clarifying that. So you mentioned tides and storm surges, but so how does climate change affect these processes and then affect flood risk in the UK specifically?
So the UK, being an island nation, we've got an awful lot of coastline, and we're exposed to different storm tracks. So as climate change impacts our weather systems, that has an impact on our coastal response, and also rising sea levels, that it elevates water levels. So the highest tides are slightly higher. Storm surges on that background water level can be slightly higher as well. So, and I guess when we think about climate change, we often think about the frequency and intensity of the storms. And this is true. If you have more storms heading along a certain track, that coastline might be more exposed to wavier conditions and higher water levels. But also, if a storm track slightly shifts in position, that can actually change the wind direction that a coastline is exposed to. So when we watch the weather forecasts, we see those kind of fingerprint images and the winds circulate around them, around the pressure systems. If we're exposed to a particular quadrant due to the position of a coastal town relative to a storm track, we might always be exposed to southwesterly winds, say. If that track shifted, maybe we would suddenly become exposed to westerly winds. And that can change the waves that are generated at that coastline and the surge that's generated. And the beaches will respond and sediment will be redistributed. So we often think climate change is all about frequency and intensity, but it can also be a change in the prevailing conditions that a coastal community is exposed to.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, from what you're explaining, it's quite clear that there's so many different processes involved. So, how do you then go about predicting flood risk? Like, what are the approaches or the methods that you use to predict all these processes and then flood risk?
Yeah, so I guess like a weather forecast, we use computer models, computer simulations to try and make a good estimate of what is going to happen in the future. And that can be over different time scales. So like a weather forecast, we might have a 5-day forecast, and that's looking at the urgent flood risk that might happen in the next few days. But we also have climate projections where we're looking into the future over the next 100 years to try and support policy and shoreline management planning. These computer models are just massive calculators. They have a lot of equations in them, which represent the processes that occur in nature. They then take weather forecasts as the inputs and the coastal conditions, and they use those forecasts to drive the ocean response and the coastal forecasts. And then climate projections look at different concentration pathways, what might happen in the future. So you get a range of potential future scenarios that can then be fed into climate models. They don't look perhaps so much at the weather systems. They look more at statistical seasonal changes to try and understand how the situation will change as we go into the future. And those model predictions are designed to support shoreline management and creating policy over much longer term timescales.
Okay, so that does that mean that your models take into account both the sort of long-term predicted trends in sea level rise and also climate change-induced changes in kind of the frequency of storms?
Yes, so some models will be purely designed to focus on the longer term climate aspects, and other models will be designed to be much more efficient so they can crunch algorithms quickly to give us these rapid forecasts to support those that are in response roles, actually managing flooding as it happens.
Okay. And so with your, so you've got your models that are supported by different kind of algorithms, but do you also feed real kind of data that has been collected into the models?
So that's really important. So monitoring feeds into modeling. That's called data assimilation. And this is to try and ensure that models don't deviate from reality. So every day a forecast is being rerun to understand what the potential hazards are over the next few days that are coming. Real-time data from weather stations, coastal observatories are feed into these models to kind of pull them back to reality if they start to deviate or show a bias. And that's to make sure that the predictions are the best that they possibly can be.
Okay. And so in terms of the predictions, could you talk a little bit about the ranges of uncertainties that that there are when you come up with a with an output of your model?
Yeah, so uncertainties can come from all sorts of different sources. Some of the uncertainty will actually be in the input information that you put into your model. So if you're using a weather forecast, you have a prediction of the winds and the pressure system. If there's any uncertainty in those predictions, that's automatically going to feed into your coastal response model. But also the initial conditions. So a forecast often has to start from a certain beach profile. And in the UK, very often we monitor beach levels twice a year. So we kind of capture seasonal change. So we might have a summer beach profile and a winter beach profile. Now, it's very rare that these profiles are put into a model in real time. And that's because it's very difficult to have monitoring systems capturing this information every low tide. But if we don't have the right beach profile, the forecast can be very different. So at the end of summer, beaches are generally very healthy, they're quite high. And at the end of winter, after high energy conditions, they're lower and have eroded in some areas. So if you are forecasting a storm that occurs towards the end of winter, but you've got this high summer beach profile, you might be under predicting the potential storm impact. Whereas if you use a much lower beach level in your initial condition, you might be over predicting the storm impact. So there are challenges around that. There's also new ways of predicting impact as well, and that's called machine learning. So this is where we start to develop new efficient computer algorithms and we train them on past data. But if conditions haven't been caught in those training data sets, if they occur in the future, they might be out of range of what that algorithm can cope with. So it's very important to have these long historic data records to train these new approaches, but also always be adding to them and also kind of ground truthing them with monitoring as events unfold.
Okay. And so you mentioned a few times the importance of monitoring, like for example, monitoring beach profiles. So who's actually responsible for doing that? Is it local communities or is there some sort of is it universities or like who actually does that?
Well, many different people monitor our beaches. There are a lot of citizen science initiatives that are starting to appear internationally all around the globe. There is something called CoastSnap, where people can place their phone in a phone cradle, take an image, and upload that to a website. And then the people hosting that website process those images to get a time lapse of beach level change. Many local authorities, coastal groups have a national monitoring program where they try and consistently collect information around the whole of the UK, even though they're responsible for their own region. So that's kind of consultancies, local authorities that form those groups. And then universities also collect data. If they've got a research project focusing on a specific study area, they generally collect additional information, but they always try and make sure that's available to the coastal groups and the monitoring programs so it can supplement that data. And I think it's really important that academics work with end users to ensure that the data that we collect is collected in a similar format so it can actually be used by the people that are managing our coastlines.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. It seems like, yeah, when you start with setting up your model, there's probably a lot of work to do to actually find out what data is available and which you will have to collect. So in your opinion, what would you say are some of the main kind of research gaps that still need to be addressed so that we can improve the flood risk prediction in the UK?
Oh, well, I'm going to answer that question with a topic that's probably my favourite topic at the minute, but another scientist would probably give you a different answer. So I'm going to talk about wave overtopping because that's a topic of interest to me at the minute. So wave overtopping is when a wave impacts a structure, a dense plume of water shoots up into the air. And then when there's an onshore wind, this plume, this spray can go over a sea defence, and then that's when it starts to interact with us. Now, I'm interested in this because it's not only carrying water across a sea defence, which causes a flood risk due to the volume of water, But the plume can also be carrying any debris from the beach. So that might be pebble, it could be driftwood, it could be anything. And if that hits a person or a car windscreen in a car park or a window on a property, that can be very damaging. But the research questions around predicting this overtopping spray, there's quite a lot of limitations and information gaps around how the wind interacts with this spray. So we've had a lot of work looking at coastal predictions where we're predicting tides, waves, but then we now need to focus our attention on the impacts when once these combinations of events actually interact with our coastline. How does that water transfer onto land and actually impact with us? And once this spray is up in the air, there hasn't been so much research around how wind interacts with it. And that's because it's very difficult to observe what goes on. And you need to have observations to be able to parameterize what's happening, make equations of the physical processes to then put them into computer models to be able to do these predictions. So very often, because it's a very high energy environment at the coast, we use laboratory experiments. So we would work in large flume tanks and have scaled experiments. So we can generate a lot of data that way to develop these modeling codes. But getting wind acting on waves in all sorts of different directions for all sorts of different structures and beach profiles is very difficult. So I'm currently interested in how can we develop monitoring technologies to actually start getting observations at the coast so we can start improving our representation of this overtopping spray.
Wow, that sounds very interesting. I'm looking forward to see what comes out of that research. And I also wanted to ask you, based on your experience from like interacting with policymakers and also engaging with the general public, what would you say are some of the biggest misconceptions when it comes to flood forecasting?
Well, I'm not quite sure what the misconceptions are. I would say policymakers, when they're making their decisions, their plans, planning strategy, they generally do want a good evidence base, to make these decisions. So they often engage with scientists to collect a science database, which they believe is credible to help support the development of a new strategy and future management plans that are resilient to climate change. So they're very engaged with science, they interact with us. But I think the challenges come when we then start talking to the general public. So when we start talking about flood risk management, people very often think about concrete seawalls. We know concrete provides a protective barrier, but going forwards, we need to think more about adaptive solutions to management and more sustainable solutions. And there's a lot of conversations around using nature-based approaches to managing coastal flood risk. But the general public perhaps don't understand how these processes work and they're quite nervous. So if you're in an area where there's perhaps salt marsh regeneration or sand dune regeneration, often the feeling is you'd much rather have that concrete seawall. Problem is, if you keep having these fix the line, hold the line concrete barriers, they actually damage the ecosystems. So by fixing that line in place with sea level rise, beaches in front of them are starting to erode or salt marsh is being lost. We're starting to lose our natural habitats. So now this is understood. We now need to actively compensate this and actually ensure we're not having a detrimental impact on ecosystem services. But I think trying to communicate this with the public, if you're someone who's perhaps at risk of flooding, you're very nervous for your property. So I think the challenges coming are how to communicate how nature-based solutions work, how they offer a resilience as well. So if you think about a community behind a very large seawall, if that seawall failed, there would be a lot of properties at risk of flooding. The water could gush through a gap in that seawall. If you are behind perhaps a nature reserve, a salt marsh area, if a storm did cause damage to that natural habitat, vegetation was lost, it can recover in the summer. So the protection could be maintained over longer timescales. And that's what we mean when we start to talk about resilience. So Concrete is a protective measure, but it isn't resilient. If it breaks and it cannot recover itself. So I think trying to understand people's concerns and trying to explain how natural solutions can be used and the level of protection they offer and how they provide resilience over longer timescales is critical. And how to have those conversations is quite challenging because if it is your personal property that's at risk, you obviously have got a lot of worries about what the future might look like.
Yes, and that really highlights how like having the perfect solution from a scientific point of view can be good, but public engagement in the end is very important for it to actually be an effective solution. And so you just mentioned this shift from kind of structural approaches or structural solutions like seawalls towards more nature-based solutions. But given the increased frequency of storms that we've seen hitting the UK in recent years, have you noticed any other shifts in the approach taken to manage flooding?
I guess my answer to that would be is we're always shifting our approaches. So if the 1953 storm is talked about a lot, after that event, you had things like the Thames Barrier being built. That's when we started initiating these concrete seawalls around the North Sea. So that was kind of our reaction to large storm events. Then, when we've got these protective measures in place, we start building our communities as we have this sense of security. Now we've kind of started to realize that concrete can have this impact on the ecosystems, and we're starting to lose habitats. We're now shifting towards looking at nature-based solutions. So, I guess we are in a, yet another transition phase where we're now starting to look at adaptive management plans and how we work with nature. Also, people who are in a kind of an operational role, they often review their kind of operations and ensure that they're fit for purpose. So if we think about the Thames Barrier, if it starts closing more frequently, then there's concerns around when the maintenance can be fitted in. So when it was initially designed, you would assume that during winter is when it's being shut, and you would have planned maintenance in summer when it isn't being closed. But now we do see large storm events in summer as well. So some of the operations need to be adjusted to plan how we work with this. We also have to think that a management plan also has a fixed design life. And as schemes come to the end of their design life, the latest climate projections are being used, the latest understanding is being used to actually design what the next approach is for an area. So we are always kind of monitoring what's happening, assessing what's happening, updating our predictions, and adapting management activities as required. So that doesn't mean every week we're doing something, but perhaps every 5 to 10 years, there is an update and a refresh to policies.
Okay. And so aside from conducting your own research, you've recently also taken the role of co-director of a new flood research center. So could you talk a little bit more about this, please?
Yeah, so this is a NERC-funded postdoctoral training centre, and it's just started, it's just launched, and our aim is to have a number of PhDs in place this summer. We will have four cohorts of studentships. The centre is led by the University of Southampton, with three other universities across the UK and three of the research centres. And the aim is to look at flooding from multiple sources. So we're going to bring together the coastal, the river, the groundwater, the rainfall, and try and have multidisciplinary studies. But the aim is to have all of the PhD projects aligned with an industry partner and an industry interest. And this is to try and improve the transition of science understanding into real-world application. I guess that's one of the challenges being a scientist. A lot of our information gets locked up in academic papers. So these projects are going to be targeted towards industry needs. And all the students will also have placements within industry. So their research is informed by the current challenges that are being faced by managers. So the program's not only going to look at the physical processes around flood hazard and improve improving our forecasts, but some of the roles will also be looking at health and well-being and also engagement. So we're going to look at a whole range of different problems associated with flooding and try and tackle these and try and improve our management going forwards.
Wow, that sounds very like a very interesting and very relevant program. And I'll make sure that I put a link to the program page in the episode description if anyone's listening. And
thank you very much.
And so I also wanted to ask if you have any kind of practical advice for researchers or coastal scientists who really want to make sure that their expertise or that their findings are used to help support shoreline management policies in the UK.
So I'd say if you're writing your own proposals, it's always good to have an industry partner, a practitioner involved, so they can help shape the work and they can help perhaps shape the outputs that are of interest to them. So the outputs are actually used directly. You can also get involved in your local coastal group. So they're very happy to have a scientist representing local interests. So they actually know what science projects are taking place, and you can provide information about what you're working in those coastal group meetings. We've also got the UK Coastal Conference that has started last year. It's a great opportunity to engage with both academics and practitioners across the UK to find out what's going on, what management issues are happening, and network and meet people. So I think the next conference will be next year, 2025, hosted in Liverpool. So look out for that. I'm sure there'll be a website soon. I'd encourage anyone and everyone to come along.
Brilliant. Thank you for all these tips. And finally, I just want to ask you, what is the biggest takeaway that you hope listeners take from this conversation?
Oh, well, I hope people have a greater appreciation for the uncertainty in flood forecasting, and hopefully they're also more aware of the importance of sustainable approaches to coastal flood management.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to take part in this podcast series. I've found this to be a very fascinating discussion, and I've definitely learned a lot of new bits of knowledge from it. So I'm sure the listeners will as well.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed this discussion as much as I did. To hear more conversations like this, you can subscribe to the CSAP YouTube channel. You can also subscribe to the CSAP newsletter to get updates on a range of topics at the interface of science and policy. All the relevant links will be in the description of this YouTube video.